Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about the ideas of utopianism that existed in the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin. It seems kind of contradictory to everything we should think and feel and believe about the Stalinist era. The popular image is one of terror. And of the hardship, often that I've talked about in this podcast, of famine. But as with any totalitarian regime, there are the regime's supporters, there are the beneficiaries from the regime, the people that think that they are going to do well out of the policies of the regime. But there were also the people who looked at a much bigger ideological and historical message put across by this particular regime and embraced its utopianism. The thing about many branches or many sort of iterations of modern political ideologies, when you look at them, is their utopianism. Nazism, for all its kind of hideousness, had at its heart a racial utopianism, but a utopianism for those of the chosen master race. For everybody else, it was going to be a pretty horrendous time. If you look at some of the ideas that spring forth from the wilder ends of liberal capitalism, the Fukuyama end of history ideas of now a world dominated by democracies and markets and all the kind of basic debates about history having come to an end. These are entirely utopian ideas. Of course, they, when they kind of have first contact with reality, they tend to crumble. The utopianism of Marxist-Leninism was that at some point in the future, throughout the struggles of socialism, at some point in the future, communism would be built, and we were in for a long period of socialist construction, and that communism would be the outcome. But it was, as Sheila Fitzpatrick calls it, an age of utopianism. And I'll read from chapter 3 in Everyday Stalinism, which is perhaps my favourite, Palaces on a Monday. She writes, "This was an age of utopianism. Political leaders had utopian visions, and so did many citizens, especially the younger generation. The spirit is hard to capture in an age of scepticism, since utopianism, like revolution, is so unreasonable. How could anyone have seriously believed in a radiant future, totally different from the miserable past and the chaotic present? The problem of understanding is all the greater because of the distance between the utopian vision and the Soviet reality. It is tempting to dismiss the vision as simply deception and camouflage, especially since the utopian rhetoric actually did serve those purposes, among others, for the Soviet regime. But the vision cannot be dismissed in a study of everyday Stalinism. Not only was it a part of Stalinism, and an important one at that, but it was also a part of everyone's everyday experience in the 1930s. A Soviet citizen might believe or disbelieve in a radiant future, but could not be ignorant that one was promised. So you will find from time to time, not just in the study of Soviet communism, but in all other different time frames and periods, that utopianism and, I suppose, kind of magical thinking, fantasy thinking, can occur. People who imagine what is to come and divorce that from the existing realities. And the existing realities, obviously, in Stalin's Russia, are extremely harsh, even when there were not periods of acute terror. What existed were periods of hardship and hunger. The period of the five-year plans, the first five-year plan particularly, saw living standards decline to a point that hadn't been seen since the Russian Civil War. So the utopianism of the 1930s was partly due to increases in and developments in technology, and partly due to the process of industrialization. Stalin envisaged really that socialism would be almost a war on the natural world, and that the natural world would be tamed, conquered, and perfected into the process of building socialism. The vision, as Sheila Fitzpatrick puts it, had very little specificity when it came to social relations and structures. The vision was nice rhetoric, but it was extremely generalised. The glorious future had very little fine detail in it, so that people could know what they were going to actually be getting. She writes, reading through the journal Maxim Gorky founded to publicise Soviet transformative feats, called Our Achievements, the vision comes across as an almost imperial one, focused on mastery of geographical space and the natural environment, and a civilising mission towards the backward inhabitants of the Soviet Union. Broad is my native land, says the famous first line of the Soviet national anthem. This was not just a description or a boast, but an assertion of core values, bigness. The Bolsheviks of the immediate revolutionary period, Lenin, Trotsky, Sverdlov, Stalin, and people of that ilk, looked upon much of Russia as something to be tamed. The peasants, who they had little time for, and had almost in some cases an obsessive hatred of, were barbarians. These were people who were not at the level of being considered full Soviet citizens. These were people who would need to be transformed in some way. Collectivization in Lenin and Stalin's thinking offered that process of creating a regimented and industrialized countryside that would be more efficient and create the basis of a socialist society through bigger grain yields and bigger harvests, hopefully. But the chaos of the countryside, the backwardness of the countryside, the superstition of the countryside, made Lenin highly suspicious of the peasantry. In his view, what a peasant represented was an agent of the old order, and the old order was deep within their thinking. And these would be a people that would be, you know, whether they liked it or not, modernised in some way. Look at the map of Russia, Lenin once said. North of Vologda, southeast of Saratov, south of Orenburg and Omsk, and north of Tomsk, stretch boundless spaces in which dozens of large cultured states could fit. And in these spaces, what reigns is patriarchalism, semi-barbarity, and real barbarity. So Lenin, in some ways, saw the potential of the vast spaces of the Soviet Union, rather like Hitler did. Hitler looked to create a racial utopia. Lenin thought that a social utopia could be created in there, and this barbarity could be swept away. The famines he and Stalin and Hitler created in the Soviet Union have some interesting connections, if slightly different motivations. One of the things that unites utopian thinkers and utopian ideologies is the idea that the benefits of the future will justify the costs of the present. So in the future, the suffering that individuals will be relieved from and the perfection of societies in the future will justify suffering in the present. So Lenin and Stalin chose who would have to make the sacrifices in order to build utopias in the distance. The fact that those utopias, there was never a kind of an arrival date on them, made the entire argument even more shaky than it already was. The key to transformation for the Bolsheviks and later the Stalinists was industrialization. Industrialization would do a number of things. Firstly, it would create the industrial base to defend the country. It would create the wealth of the country. But it would create the right kinds of people as well. As factories grew and wages from factories were better than those working on the land, the peasants would be sucked into towns and cities, and the process of industrialization and education would transform them into modern Soviet citizens, the proletariat. And it was to the workers that Stalin and his contemporaries looked to create a basis of support. Both Lenin and Stalin believed that it was very unlikely that the peasants would support the party in the long run, because the peasants were infused with these petty bourgeois ideals about land ownership and private wealth, and they understood nothing of the revolution and nothing of the kind of the sacrifice and selflessness it would require to help build a socialist society. So they were never going to be the natural constituency of Bolshevik or Stalinist support. Sheila Fitzpatrick quotes, "The time has come to take all the riches of the country into our hands," an editorialist proclaimed. "The time has come to construct our fatherland anew with the hands of machines, to dress the whole country from Archangel to Tashkent, from Leningrad to Vladivostok, in the iron armour of industrial giants, to weave the whole country into a network of electrical power lines. Only by bringing modern industry to those boundless spaces could their inhabitants be rescued from the colonialist oppression of the Tsarist days and offered de facto, as opposed to mere de jure, equality in the Russian heartland." That's a really important significant difference, de facto and de jure equality. One can announce that people have equal rights all day long, but if you're not matching that with the practical improvements in living standards in people's lives, then there is no equality. The generation who were born after the revolution, or who were small children at the time of the revolution and grew up in the 1930s, had an experience that probably people here in the 21st century will not easily relate to.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Are enlightened to experience themselves, and might find kind of slightly alien. But it was the idea that together they were participating in the building of history, in sort of historical construction itself. If you look at the founding ideas of Marxist-Leninism, if you look at Marx's theory, which suggests that perhaps kind of unconsciously almost, for most of human history, we've been going through this process of class struggle, and now when we're into socialism, that's when we build communism and we reach the end of history, the kind of historical eschatological endpoint. Well, to be aware of that suddenly gives you the option of choosing to participate in it or not, and to be own part of the outcome. And this, to many Soviet citizens, was a terrifically exciting proposition. That their lives would be geared towards building socialism, and that they were consciously, along with the state, constructing the future in their own little ways. Most people, in fact, nearly all people, have no experience of this in their day-to-day lives, and view would probably most people today would view this as a kind of a strange and an alien practice. So the generation that grew up after Lenin and grew up into Stalinism believed in their hearts that they were there to make the scientifically advanced technological future into reality. Many of the memoirs about the period, including those written in exile, talk about optimism, idealism, and normally among young people, particularly among the Soviet young pioneers, and the belief that those involved were part of a process of historic transformation, the building of socialism, and the idea that they were kind of pushing back frontiers of the possible. And for those who were involved in this, to some extent they were right. They were building the future, and the state actively wanted to involve them in this process. The state actively wanted them to consider that this was what they should be doing. The idea of being a pioneer was immensely popular. Younger element of the Komsomol youth movement were the young pioneers. But in Soviet literature, in magazines and novels and stories and cartoons, there are constant tales of pioneers and particularly pilots and Arctic explorers going to the limits of civilized society and going beyond that, deep into the wildernesses of the Soviet Union, and taming the land. Once again, we come back to this idea, this Stalinist idea of being there being a war really to conquer nature, and the terrific levels of environmental vandalism and pollution that went with it were perhaps only realised to the rest of the world by about the 1970s. People, by and large, who participated in this process of historic construction were either oblivious to or they were able to mitigate or able to justify terror, but they certainly, to them, Stalinist terror was not the key feature of the period, and those that had fallen victim to it had in some way deserved their fate for being counter-revolutionaries. So Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "Terror was not part of this picture. Alexei and Zhubi, son-in-law of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, an editor of Izvestia, was a schoolboy in 1937. He recalled, "The only thing that existed for us that year was Spain, the fight with the fascists, Spanish caps, blue with red edging on the visor, came into fashion, and also big berets, which were tilted at a rakish angle for boys and girls of that time. The world was divided only into whites and reds. It didn't even come to our heads to think which side we were on. It was that red world in which the polar explorers, the Chelyuskinites, who were rescuers of a team stranded in the Arctic in 1934, and the Papapinites, Ivan Papapin was a record-breaking aviator, lived and accomplished their heroic feats." So what he's saying there is this spirit of the pioneer, this spirit of pushing back boundaries and frontiers, and it was an entirely, in his view, in the view of the Stalin generation, an entirely sort of egalitarian pursuit. People of the lowest social backgrounds were now, those that would have been the lowest social backgrounds under the previous regime, were now able to fully participate in this kind of pioneering activity. That all was what socialism to them was. And anything that was the antithesis of that, i.e. Spanish fascism, needed to be fought and struggled against and defeated. And that was just absolute perfect logical sense. And Sheila Fitzpatrick also quotes Raisa Orlova, who was a dissident, though a contemporary of Adjube's, and she remembered her youth in the 1930s, saying, "I had an unshakable faith that my existence between these old walls in an apartment on Gorky Street was merely a preparation for life. Life, properly speaking, would begin in a new and sparkling White House. There I would do exercises in the morning. There the ideal order would exist, and all my heroic achievements would commence." The majority of my contemporaries shared the same kind of rough, provisional, slapdash way of life. Faster, faster, towards the great goal, and there everything would begin in a genuine sense. It was both possible and necessary to alter everything: the streets, the houses, the cities, the social order, human souls. And it was not all that difficult. For the unselfish enthusiasts would outline the plan on paper. Then they would tear down the old, saying all the while, "You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs." Then the ground would be cleared, and the rubble of the edifice of the socialist phalanx would be erected in the space that had been cleared. So there we have it. There we have a real snapshot of the ideas of beginnings, of new starts, of utopias being formed. The all over saying that everything was a kind of a prelude to the real event, which was going to be this White House she would live in. It's kind of a metaphor for perfection, and that there would be those who were unselfish, those who were selfless, would help construct this new world. Now, I've talked a lot in the past about the fellow traveller movement, the European and mainly American intellectuals who were not communists themselves, but were sympathetic towards communism, looking at it as being a positive thing in Russia, though perhaps not something they wanted to bring home for their own societies. And you can see how, by visiting Russia, they experienced this infectious enthusiasm. These are the people they spoke to. These are the people they interacted with. These are the people who articulated to them, in all sincerity, the dream world that Stalinism presented. And these are the people who were the advocates for that world, who articulated it to a Western audience, who were easily taken in by it. And we're going to return to this topic. There's an awful lot to say about utopianism in the Soviet Union, so we're going to kind of work our way through it. And the next thing we're going to look at is the plans to rebuild Moscow and the development of the Moscow Underground, which, if you've never been there, is truly an awesome sight to behold. But we'll stop there. Thanks very much for listening, everybody. And I'll hopefully get another podcast out before Christmas. Have a good one. Try not to stress in the upcoming festivities. And we'll catch you soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.